Hello, podcast listeners, and thank you for coming back. I think maybe I need to apologize.
What have you done?
Well, I was pretty heavy on the pitch last week.
That was good. We need the pitch. We need people who love this program to help support it, because otherwise we go silent.
Tell them about that.
Well, neither you nor I takes a salary. We put what money comes from the program back into it, and a lot of that is simply getting it up onto the sites from which people can download it and listen to it. There's a fee to participate in the dissemination of public radio, and we have 60 or some stations around the country.
We get somebody who sends us a letter who's really mad, and I'm going to call a public radio and tell them to stop your funding. Oh, I wish.
Yeah, they'll do that all right.
Yeah, we don't get any funding.
We pay some money for the editing and technology, but essentially we're unpaid, and we do it as a labor of love. And my goal is not to get rich doing it. My goal is to make it grow so that it can address more people. I just came back from my annual Lewis and Clark trip, and I met 24 people who listen to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And when you hear them, David, it's so moving, because this program makes a difference in people's lives. They say it, and I don't think they're making it up. And so I would like to have the chance to meet more people, to address a wider audience, to, in some sense, be a voice in this country, in this show, what we do for reason and civility and good sense and historical rigor.
Granted, your point is made and understood, but I've learned so much from the study of Jefferson, particularly in civil discourse and how powerful that could be. You know, we talked to Bo Wright a week ago and joked about afterwards about getting some hardcore left and right wing politicians on to talk to Jefferson. I'm serious about that. I mean, you study Jefferson, you learn civil discourse, and why.
He was a gracious man. He understood that every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. He understood something that's been largely forgotten, that is, in our system, majority rule has to prevail. So, you know, 51% of the Congress can decide policy for this country. Those are the rules that we established. Today's loser might be the winner tomorrow or next year or next decade. We only have one way of settling public disputes, and that's through the ballot, through majority rule, and that whenever we despair of that, we're really losing our optimism about living in a free and self-governing society. To think that there will be unanimity on almost any question, and that includes North Korea or Iran or an Islamic incident in Paris, to think that there would be unanimity in a nation of 300 million people on any question is silly. And so how do you solve these policy questions for a third of a billion people? You do it by representative government and majority rule. And Jefferson thought you have to bring a level of grace, goodwill, tolerance, affection, and respect to that project, or it just becomes a kind of majoritarian nightmare. And today, David, we're living in a kind of majoritarian nightmare, and we have to get out from under it. And so what I saw in the collapse of the Republican health care proposal was a willingness by a number of Republicans to reach out to say to the Democrats, this is too big an issue for one party to solve. We're going to have to try to find some method to do it together. And if that bears fruit, that may be the first glimmer of a recovery.
But on this week's show... we talked about a subject Jefferson would have approved of immensely.
Books.
He would not like that they were all about him, but...
He would think, what? Enough already on books about me. Write about the Enlightenment.
But it was just such a hoot. You texted me about this week's show and said, there's this new book by Bowles, and I've read the introduction on it, and it was like... it was like a mind reading thing.
You were doing the same thing.
I had just read the introduction and thought, I wonder if there's any way I could get Clay to talk about this.
Well, now we need to get Mr. Bowles on this program.
Yes, well, we agreed.
We should send it to him. You know, if you get me a copy of the electronic file, I'll send it to him and say, hey, we talked about your book. Would you like to come on and talk about it?
I think probably have to go. Well, he's at Rice, isn't he?
He's at Rice. It should be easy enough to find
him. A guy like you, sure, you could talk to him. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'll write to him if you give me the wherewithal.
Of course. Well, it's your show.
No, so. But I mean, I don't know. I'm electronically idiotic, and so the idea of you need to send me and say, this is the file to point him to.
Yeah, you need to speak to the internet elf. He'll fix
I've
you
heard
up.
Of this yeah, guy, yeah.
So let's go on to the show. It's a long discussion about books, and we touch on your book, too.
And meanwhile, fund this program if you can.
We appreciate it so much.
And thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Joining us this week is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, my friend.
Clay, I was hoping we could have a maybe semi-serious conversation this week about something Jefferson always enjoyed talking about, and that is books.
I came back from my annual Lewis and Clark tour in Montana and Idaho, and the happiest thing occurred when I walked up there on my front step were two book packages. And I opened them up, and one of them, I don't know whether I ordered this or someone sent it to me, I'm never quite sure these days, but it's John B. Bull's new book, Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty.
Well, that's really the book that's getting all the notice in the press right now, but there's been a number of interesting books that have come out in the past couple of years about Jefferson.
He's an endlessly fascinating character, and we're trying to figure out, I think, how to make sense of him in this era when questions of moral responsibility, particularly with respect to race and slavery, have sort of overwhelmed the conversation.
We had a couple of weeks ago a show called This Thing of Darkness, where we discussed Jefferson and slavery. It was a pretty dark show.
But I think it was one of the most important programs we ever did.
Well, we started to get comments on that.
What kind of comments are you getting?
Let's save those and address them specifically in a future show. But I'm back to the book,
though. So I opened the book, and I just love to open a new book on Jefferson because it's like a new lens, a new window on something that's been a fascination of mine all of my adult life. I should just say that John B. Bowles is the William P. Hobby Professor of History at Rice University and formerly the editor of the Journal of Southern History. And he says that he's going to attempt an actual full-on biography of Jefferson in one volume. It's called Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty. And when I opened it, David, I had about an hour to read when I got back, and I saw that in his introduction he addresses the issue of the inconsistencies and the paradoxes of Jefferson's life. And when I saw that, I immediately perked up because that's my theme. And I've been working on a book endlessly. I hope to finish it soon, called The Paradox of Thomas Jefferson, which tries to sort this out in my own way. And so I read with great interest his short introduction about this subject.
I read it too, and I thought it was interesting when we talked about this week's show.
I thought we could go through it almost line by line, and then I'll comment, and then I'm going to read my first few paragraphs from my book on Thomas Jefferson.
But before we go there, just some background. There have been so many books written about Jefferson. Now, your favorites are the
Joseph Ellis, the character of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, and also Merrill Peterson, Thomas Jefferson and the New Nation.
And the Dumas Malone, too.
And then Malone's sixth volume, massive, authoritative, but very friendly biography of Thomas Jefferson.
So I guess my question to you before we get into this is, why another book on Jefferson? Why? Historically, is there that much new information? Is it just a matter of interpretation or all of the above?
All of the above. So when John Meacham produced his book on Jefferson, he clearly had a team of researchers and they scoured around and found some actual new information. Not essential information, but contextual information about the life and times of Jefferson that really made that an important contribution to Jefferson studies. It's not the best biography in my view, but it's important because he had the intellectual infrastructure, that is a research staff, to really go find some new material and to be able to use it as a way to buttress his examination. His view is that Jefferson was a man quite comfortable with power, no matter what Jefferson himself might have had to say about that. So each new book provides a new perspective. Sometimes new information is revealed. We have to sort this through. So if you go back to Dumas Malone's six-volume Jefferson, it's a great book. But even when I read it in the 1980s, I had to kind of choke sometimes at how entirely, almost illimitably favorable the treatment of Jefferson was. I mean, Malone basically believed that Jefferson could do no wrong. That didn't even sit well with me intellectually in the 1980s. Now, after all that's happened since in Jefferson historiography and our increased sensitivity to questions of race, gender, American Indians, and class, it's hard more than ever to take Malone's book fully seriously. That's sad because here's this extraordinary achievement, which is in some ways flawed to the point that it's no longer being recommended in college classrooms, it's even in graduate studies.
You're saying sort of a dangerous thing, which is we're judging these biographies based on the time in which they were written. And we're talking about one that's less than half a century ago, and you're discounting it because of historical perspective.
I'm not discounting it. I'm saying that it has this flaw, and that flaw hurts it because we now have, I think, a much, much more balanced view of the history of the early national period, and particularly the life and achievement of Jefferson, than we had when Malone wrote his six-volume masterpiece. And if he were alive today and he were a 30-year-old, he would go through and he would adjust this extraordinary book to take advantage of the perspectives that have emerged. I'm not saying that you follow the whims of the age in which you happen to find yourself, but I'm saying you must. He wrote the book as if slavery were not a significant issue in Jefferson's life. We can no longer, and this was the burden of the program that we did and that you've been talking about, this thing of darkness. We can now no longer look at Jefferson without factoring in slavery in almost every possible anecdote, incident, scenario, era, or achievement of his life. I think that's good. It can go too far, and I think it has gone too far. But Malone's book is on the other side of a cultural revolution that has been extremely helpful on the whole for the way we view the darker aspects of American history. So some books kind of bring us up and face the world as we now see it. I'm sure that 30 years from now, the historiography of our time will be in somewhat discredited and will be regarded as old hat. There's also intellectual faddishness, David, and I just read a review of H.W. Brand's new book about MacArthur and Truman, and this was in the Times Literary Supplement, and it said, oh, we love H.W. Brand's because he doesn't have an axe to grind. He doesn't have an agenda. He doesn't have a political agenda as a historian and biographer. That's where we are. Today, almost every book you pick up has some sort of an agenda, a strong perspective, point of view, politics, judgmentalism, that in my opinion will really weaken the longevity of those books because they reflect our own moral righteousness, not any attempt to get objectively at a subject as interesting and complex as that of Thomas Jefferson.
Okay, so I thank you, sir, for allowing me to sidetrack you a bit. We were talking about Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty by John Bowles.
So how do you write a book about Thomas Jefferson now that the cat is out of the bag, that slavery is now a kind of dark ink that spreads itself around anything you try to do about the world of Thomas Jefferson? How do you write a book that is fair to Jefferson, fair to history, fair to our consciousness, fair to the historical tradition in this difficult time for Jefferson? I think that's why Bowles wrote the book. I think that's why he wrote the introduction, because he didn't want to just say he was born on the 13th of April, 1743. He wanted to start by saying, I get it, that this is a difficult time to try to make sense of Thomas Jefferson.
It would be good to talk to him at some time in the future.
We should get him on this program. I admire this book.
Both of us need to finish reading it before we do that.
Indeed.
Would you like to quote some things from the introduction?
I'm going to read a couple passages and then you do, and we'll just go through it. But let me start. He says, and this is what grabbed my attention in the introduction, Thomas Jefferson puzzles us. By birth, education, and demeanor, an aristocrat, he was the most thoroughgoing Democrat of the Founding Fathers. As learned and bookish a man as any other of his era, he himself only wrote one book, accidentally, and merely attempted half-heartedly to write an autobiography. The most widely traveled and cosmopolitan of the founders, he never journeyed south of his home state of Virginia or farther than 50 miles west of Monticello. So I'll stop there. Book begins, He was a puzzle, absolutely. Now, I do quibble here. He says that the most widely traveled and cosmopolitan of the fathers, that's not really so. That Adams was more widely traveled. Franklin was more widely traveled. A number of people would claim that. And so when I see something like that, David, you know, it's not an error. It's not a major problem. But I think, uh-oh, he's maybe not spent enough time reading about Jefferson and his world, if he can make a statement like that, because he certainly wasn't the most well-traveled of the founding fathers. Then he says, a hesitant, ineffective orator, he was a sensational conversationalist. I disagree with that, too. He was a hesitant and ineffective orator, but Jefferson was not a great conversationalist. He was a great host.
Well, no, wait a minute. We have written accounts of him. You've always talked about how in a dinner party he was able to speak to each individual and make them feel as if they were the only one at the table.
He drew people out. He was gracious and friendly and hospitable and encouraging. But his conversation, he subordinated his own conversation to encourage it in others.
Wasn't it Humboldt who visited him?
Yes, and loved the conversations.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's basis for
yeah,
that.
Jefferson knew something about everything, and he could follow along. But, you know, you think of a conversationalist, you think of someone like Mark Twain or Dr. Samuel Johnson or Theodore Roosevelt, someone who knew how to hold forth. That's not really Jefferson. Jefferson was much more egoless, a man who had overcome any ego attachment and was able to say, I think this person is extremely interesting. I will do what I can to make her or him flourish in this conversation.
It's hard for me to really criticize that statement, though, based on the Humboldt description of him being such a great conversationalist. I mean, is it maybe what you define great conversationalist as?
Yes, and I would have taken the word sensational out. I've never used that term for Jefferson. I'm not quibbling with this book. I'm just having fun. This is how I read books. I'm sure it's how you read them, too. One more sentence before our break. Known around the globe for penning the words, all men are created equal, he was a lifelong slaveholder. You know, fair enough. You have to come to terms with that. There's no way to get around it.
Jefferson, the Architect of American Liberty, a new biography by John Bowles. And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation, well, this week about President Thomas Jefferson. More specifically, we're talking about a new book, Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty by John Bowles. And you had said you wanted to center the conversation around the introduction. We both have confessed that we have not completed the book. Both of us also have agreed that we will complete the book.
I admire the book. I've read about half of it. I've taken scores of pages of notes. And I've added to my own knowledge of Jefferson by reading Mr. Bowles' interesting perspective.
When we stopped, you had read a statement about Jefferson and slavery.
He was a liberty-loving slaveholder. We got that. So that goes without saying. Pick it up from there, David.
One of the points that stuck out to me when I read the introduction was we should begin by acknowledging that Jefferson lived in a world fundamentally different from ours. It was pre-Darwinian, which is only one reason most people in general did not expect much change in their lives.
No, it's an outstanding insight. Jefferson lived on the other side of Freud, on the other side of Marx and on the other side of Darwin. And that is just a huge intellectual milieu difference between his time and ours. And if you don't factor that in, David, you can't possibly understand Jefferson.
Yeah, so that stuck out. And then the following that, he writes, Jefferson's society was, compared to today, remarkably undemocratic, even though it was more democratic than any other society of the time.
Yeah, outstanding.
You know, I love that kind of perspective because, going back to our discussion about slavery, it's, you know, how did these guys think? Well, they didn't understand the basic theories that Darwin put forth. That's a big deal.
Jefferson didn't believe in extinction. He
right.
told Lewis to look for the woolly mammoth. Jefferson didn't believe with Freud that the great bulk of what goes on in our consciousness is below the radar, that we're not really very deeply in touch with our deepest selves, that our surface rationality, the world that Jefferson lived in, is not a complete picture. It's not even the beginning of a complete picture if you want to understand the errancy and vagrancy and oddness of human achievement and behavior.
The society then was remarkably undemocratic. He goes on to say that rigid expectations governed what women could and could not do. Blacks were hardly considered persons, and racial slavery was commonplace throughout the nation.
Yeah, and he also says, this is on his page two, and I think this is exactly right, David. Surely an interpretive middle ground is possible, if not necessary, if we hope to understand the enigma that is Thomas Jefferson. We must view him holistically and within the rich context of his time and place. This biography aims to provide that perspective. Right on. I certainly completely agree with that.
He writes also, a new democratic age was dawning, but its implications were poorly understood.
Including sometimes by Jefferson.
Yeah.
Empower the people, and suddenly you have Andrew Jackson. They couldn't really see where this was going. That's what led Alexis de Tocqueville to come here in the 1830s, because he said, the future is going to be America and American-like dynamics. We'd better look at the laboratory and see where this is heading. And when Tocqueville came here and wrote his masterpiece, he did not admire everything that he saw.
I must confess, I have not read all of de Tocqueville.
Democracy in America is one of the greatest books ever written about democracy and about the United States, and there's a lot of Jefferson in it, although Jefferson had been dead for half a decade by the time that Tocqueville arrived here. But my point is that Jefferson seems to be like a proto-Democrat, small d, but I don't think he knew where this was headed, and that's an argument, a perspective that Bowles has, that these people were sort of on the edge of something that was coming and that Jefferson sensed it and advocated it. He might not have actually liked all the implications of what he seemed to be advocating had he lived to see them.
And that's really a pivot point for me in trying to understand his mindset. But it was beyond the imagination of these men. Is that fair?
They saw the world differently from us. I mean, literally, not just in some sort of metaphoric way, but when they looked at the world, their set of presuppositions, assumptions, foundational thoughts, their metaphysics, their very way of understanding, their, to use a technical term, their epistemology, was a product of the world up till that time, so much as they understood it. But it's a different world from ours in so many extraordinary ways that to try to make Jefferson one of us, like essentially one of us who happens to be trapped in the early 19th century, is a mistake. And I think Bowles is quite right to point that out. He says at the end of page two, as much as we might wish, Jefferson was not a modern man. That really helps when you look at the way he treated his daughters or the way he thought about women in politics or even the way he looked at African Americans.
Let me follow that with one more sentence that I'd love to get you to comment on, and that is, though the most democratically minded of any of the founders, he still expected elite white men who shared his views to lead government.
And here's an even starker sentence, same page. The most elegant defender of liberty in our nation's history did not defend the liberty of those whose lives it would have most transformed. There's a strong sentence. Think of that. I'm going to read it again. The most elegant defender of liberty in the nation's history did not defend the liberty of those whose lives it would have most transformed. Think of that.
Well, he believed and expected elite white men who shared his views to lead the government. I mean, he couldn't really imagine anybody but somebody like him being in government.
He couldn't even really take Andrew Jackson, who was not that different from a Virginia plantation owner. So this book restores the sense of Jefferson as an aristocrat, as an elitist, as an Anglo-Saxon American who had a very difficult time seeing beyond the limits of his own class, gender, and race. I think that's excellent. But here's a sentence from page 4 that I loved, David. Jefferson happened to live at a moment in history when societies across the globe were undergoing fundamental changes in governance, and the resulting challenge attracted his energies and interests as nothing else did. That's excellent. So here was this is what Tocqueville's talking about, that there's something's going on, there's something in the water, the democratic movement is coming around the world. It would come later to some places. 1848 is the year of universal revolution in Europe. That's a whole generation after Jefferson had died. But something is happening. There's a leavening. There's the French Revolution. There's the Enlightenment, the works of Rousseau and Voltaire and David Hume and so on. And Jefferson was aware of this, that there's some sort of a tidal change was occurring in the way that the world saw human rights and self-government or any kind of government. And Jefferson was sort of in it. He was, in a way, articulating those principles and riding that wave. He was a successful surfer through the world of his times, and yet in some ways was seeing through a glass dimly, not quite sure where this was heading and not quite certain of what had led to it.
He deals with slavery, and if you skip ahead a bit in the introduction, he writes that he knew slavery to be wrong, but was also certain that for reasons of inherent inequalities between the races, as well as a legacy of mutual hatred, whites and blacks could not live together in harmony. Do you believe that?
Yes. He said that there would be permanent or nearly permanent race tension between the two races because of the fact of the dynamics of slavery, that former slaves would always feel frustrated and bitter and maybe seeking reprisal, and that former masters would always feel superior and yet anxious because of the crimes that they had done to African Americans.
And that sentence is Jefferson's justification for slavery, right?
Yes. His justification for slavery is,
there has to be a master.
That comes from Aristotle, the idea of a natural slave and a natural master. I think Jefferson's view was, if you look at them as they emerge from tribal primitiveness in Africa, in some limited sense, it's inevitable and natural that we would lead them out of that tribal morass into something like civil society, and it's going to take a long time, and we should not be overly optimistic about the project because they are either inferior to us because of geographic circumstance, or they are inferior to us in nature. Either way, it's an important social problem, and it would be foolish not to acknowledge that. Now, you and I have a hard time even articulating such sentences, but these were widely held views in the Enlightenment in the age of Jefferson. Here's one that I love. This kind of sums it up from his page 4. The issues of race and slavery are so important to us today that they almost overwhelm our view of Jefferson. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another one. This is maybe the hardest sentence for me to absorb. Indeed, to put Jefferson in the context of his own times is to see that for him, race and slavery were generally not of central importance. Think of that, David. Today, we think of race and slavery as fundamentally, quintessentially central to any understanding of this. But in Jefferson's time, I repeat, to put Jefferson in the context of his own times is to see that for him, race and slavery were generally not of central importance. Wow, that's, I always say 8 of the first 12 presidents were slaveholders, and that's what that sentence tells us.
I agree. It's tough to absorb.
Here's the end of his introduction. I just want to read a 5 or 6 sentences here, talking about demythologizing and so on. Can we recognize the failures of those who came before us and yet acknowledge their contributions? That indeed is the great question, David. Says Bowles, I have tried to do just that, to humanize and contextualize Jefferson without either deifying or demonizing him. Hooray. Jefferson challenges us more thoroughly than any other founder, but in the end, he is the most attractive, most elusive, most complicated, most intellectual, most practical, most idealistic, most flexible, and most quintessentially American founder of them all.
If I can back up, there's one that,
of course,
I really liked. He writes, "We should not expect him to have embraced the values of a cosmopolitan, progressive person of the 21st century. How could he possibly have done so? Instead, we should try to understand the constraints, legal, financial, personal, intellectual, under which he lived."
And then he says, getting at my issue of the judgmentalism and the righteousness of our time, including in major historians, he says right after the sentence you just quoted, "To understand certainly does not mean to approve or even to forgive. Rather, it means to comprehend why Jefferson made the kinds of decisions he made and saw the world as he did."
He was a gentle, well-educated, idealistic man who sought, by his lights, to do right.
Yet, at times he acted in ways we now find abhorrent. Appreciating how this can be so is the task of the Jefferson scholar, the student of history, and perhaps every American citizen.
And welcome to the Thomas Jefferson.
So aside from a few quibbles that I have with the first page of his introduction, I think this is a very fine piece of work, David. And it's generous, it's thoughtful, it's balanced, it's centrist. It acknowledges the issue of his inconsistencies, but it doesn't get stuck there. He steadfastly wants to avoid judgment. He believes that unless you contextualize these figures, you can't possibly understand them, and that the fatal mistake that we could make is to try to make Jefferson one of us, a modern person, whatever progressive construct we have in our minds, to try to conform Jefferson to what we would have liked him to have been or what we think we are in our own time and place. That's great history.
In the first chapter of the book, he talks about young Jefferson, and for me, that's always a little dicey because it doesn't matter who writes it. There's not a lot of hard, solid information to base it on.
Well, there was the fire. So there was the fire in 1770 that burned down Shadwell, his boyhood home, and Jefferson reported that he had lost almost everything, that he had lost most of his private papers, all of his law notes, many of his books, only a handful of books survived. One of his trusted slaves was able to save his violin. But imagine if your house burned down when you're in your 20s and everything that you had accumulated up till that point was gone and gone forever and could not be recovered. So there's this gap. The first letter we have from Jefferson is when he was 16 and thinking of going to William and Mary. That letter survives because of its recipient. Later, Jefferson decided to keep a copy of every letter that he wrote, maybe because of the fire that had devastated Shadwell, but there's a gap. And Jefferson also then destroyed his correspondence between himself and his wife, Martha, and so there's a second gap.
Circling back in our conversation when we were talking about, I asked you about historians being affected by the time in which they completed their work. Could we look back to some of the earliest Jefferson biographies for more insight on this time?
Well, there's a great book by Merrill Peterson called The Jefferson Image in the American Mind. It was a pioneering book. People have done it for Lincoln. A friend of mine is now doing it for Theodore Roosevelt. It's not about Jefferson per se, although, of course, there's a lot of biographical information in this book. But Peterson's book, The Jefferson Image in the American Mind, follows Jefferson's reputation in American memory decade by decade from his death in 1826 until the 1970s. We now need an update on that extraordinary book because of the plummeting of Jefferson's place in American memory that's occurred since the 1970s. But this happens with every figure. Washington is the father of his country. Then he turns out to be a kind of a wooden, stiff guy with rhinoceros teeth. Then he becomes this freedom lover who in his will freed his slaves at the death of his wife, Martha. He's now a great general. Sometimes he's not a great general. Different historians and biographers in different eras of American history go back to look at the same set of basic texts and conclude different things. And so if you want to understand Jefferson, you should start with the early biographies and work your way through straight up until today. And if you read them all, or even if you read one in 10, but with a representative sample from every decade or era, you would gain a more holistic and more synthetic, more integrated understanding of Jefferson. And I think if you read those biographies and then looked at his status today, you would be ashamed at our brand of judgmental historiography, which does everything in its power to condemn Jefferson, to see him as a hypocrite, to see him as woefully paradoxical or inconsistent, to believe that he was a power-hungry man pretending to be an ancient Roman citizen like Cincinnatus, to believe that he was a rapist, and so on. We've been through this. But the current historiography on Jefferson is almost uniformly critical, negative, and judgmental. And that's why I so like this book, although I haven't finished it, by John Bowles, because he wants to say, look, we have to deal with the whole man, A, and he's not just a figure of race, and B, we have to see him in his own time, not that we just lock him there, but we have to at least start with him there, and C, who do we think we are, just dipping in with our righteousness and making judgments when our duty as historians is to try to understand, to illuminate, to excavate, to evaluate, but not to sit in judgment as if we're St. Peter or, you know, we have a right somehow to declare that which we like and that which we dislike in American history.
We need to take a short break in just a moment here, Clay, but you earlier talked about a book that you've been working on that you, how did you put it, hope to finish?
Yeah, soon, I hope.
About the paradox of Thomas Jefferson. Perhaps after our break you can share some of that book with us?
I'll read the first two pages, which are my attempt at the same story.
Wrapping up the Bowles book, as far as you're concerned, it's a good read, a must read?
I won't say till I finish, but I'll tell you one clue, and this is in his childhood you were just talking about. He says that his relations with his mother appear to have been harmonious and good. Hallelujah. Finally, somebody who doesn't say just because Jefferson said one rather wry thing about his mother's social standing that he disliked her or that there was tension between them. I've never believed that. I've always believed that historians have rushed to judgment on the relationship between Jefferson and his mother. And Bowles says, you know, we have no basis for looking at it as if it were a tense relationship.
So we both have our reading assignments and we'll get to it. Meanwhile, we need to take a short break. But we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation. This week we really are having a conversation about President Thomas Jefferson. And you called this conversation, Clay, based on a book.
John B. Bowles' new book, Jefferson, Architect of American Liberty, a splendid hardcover copy with a beautiful dust jacket, was waiting for me when I returned from my annual Lewis and Clark cultural tour. I opened that Amazon box with joy, and there it was. And I thought, this is great. I now have 500 pages to sift through, taking extensive notes, quibbling maybe here and there, affirming some things that I know, learning new things, but taking on yet another new perspective on Thomas Jefferson. And so far, I'm only about 150 pages in. The book has held up well for me. I greatly approve of his point of view. I like his introduction about the paradoxes of Jefferson a great deal.
Yeah, I read that and I could hear your voice. I really could. Before we get into talking about what we agreed to talk about before the break, which is your work on Jefferson's. I asked you about earlier biographies, and I meant like early 1800s. You know, some of the earliest books that, you know, the stuff that you can get free on your e-reader. Do you, how do you hold those?
They're good. In fact, Randall's biography, it's three volumes, I believe. He got to interview some of the grandchildren. So he knows some things that nobody else is in a position to know. Some of the stories that we take for granted come from Randall's painstaking work. It, you know, it doesn't hold up as a synthetic and careful biography of Jefferson, but it holds up as the best thing we have that gets closest to the actual life of Jefferson and perpetuates a number of oral traditions that would not have found their way into print. So if you haven't read it, Henry Randall's three-volume biography of Jefferson is essential reading for anyone who's interested in the great man.
There's a number of them, and I guess I'm just astounded when I think about these authors during that time.
They had to use actual pen and paper, David.
Yeah, no internet.
No cut, no paste, no Wikipedia.
Probably real limited access to any research but their own.
They had to go to archives. They had to do the hard work of scholarship. You know, today, with the internet, there's almost nothing that any person of reasonable intelligence can't write about.
Well, you know, a project you're involved in that makes me think about it is the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. I mean, the intention is to digitize every document, photograph that there is of Theodore Roosevelt and thus make it available to anyone for research.
It's astounding. You know, I do a lot of work on the explorer, Sir Richard Francis Burton, so I just came off this Lewis and Clark trip, and I want to read something about the source of the Nile. So I went on the internet and I looked under Google Books, and there is a complete edition of the works, some 58 of them, I think, of Sir Richard Francis Burton, free, searchable online. The number of books that are out of copyright that are now available that you could never assemble. It would have taken me 5 years to assemble all of Burton's books. It would have cost me a fortune. I would have been getting obscure books from New Zealand and Nigeria and so on. And now I get it free.
You're really answering one of the initial questions I asked you, which is why more books? Why more books? Well, because
it's easier now.
Well, not just that, but granted, I'm sure in a lot of ways it is easier. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, because you have so much more information to sort through.
It is, but we live in a time of breathtaking access, and it's only going to get much, much better as time goes on. We're reaching the point where every significant book from the past will be available online, free, searchable 24 hours per day. And copyright probably will not hold up very well in the 21st century. We're going to have to find a different way to protect intellectual property. But, you know, almost everybody simul-publishes now, so that you publish. When I go to Amazon, I say, I want to buy John Bowles' book. And I order it. One click. It's there the next day. And then it says, you want to start reading now? And then they, if you've bought it, they make it available electronically to you instantaneously. It's a breathtaking time. And, you know, there's no excuse for ignorance anymore, because a person without money, I mean, if you have no money at all but enough money to buy an iPad, you can read 100,000 books free. You can read 500,000 books free.
Speaking of books, let's talk about yours and why aren't you finishing it?
That's a good question. If you would only help. I need an amanuensis.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and that operation can be had, by the way. No, I need help. I need a research assistant. You know, I need a lot of things. I need time. I need dedication. I need confidence. You know, I wrote a book about Meriwether Lewis that I'm very proud of. I've written 9 books. I'm proud of all of them, but particularly proud of 3 or 4 of them. But when I come to Jefferson, I tremble a little, because it's Jefferson. I want to get it right, David. I want it to be a book that people say, yes, this is a really good book on Thomas Jefferson. I don't want it to be just another okay book on Jefferson. I want it to be the insight about Jefferson. And so that has kind of a paralytic effect on me.
Well, 2 things about that. I'm not sure that book will ever exist. And the other is, take all the time you want.
Well, the clock is ticking, my friend.
No, get off your own back.
You should have seen me at mile 7 on the Wendover March. I was thinking, Oh, I see. You do grow older.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to prioritize. You may have to give some things up that you don't want to.
Maybe have to work out a little intellectually as well as physically. You know, you have to work out as much mentally as if you were running a marathon.
Why do you think I do this show?
Yeah. Dream higher, as I always say.
No.
At this point.
Okay. So tell me about your book, what you've got.
So it's The Paradox of Thomas Jefferson, and it starts, my attempt is to solve this paradox, not just to state it, but to solve it. And I think that I have answers to many of the critiques of Jefferson that if you really think about it instead of just judge, he makes more sense. But when I read Bowles' introduction, I thought of my own. I dragged it out, and I have a copy of the first two pages here. And if, with your permission, I would read a little.
Oh, please.
So here's my introduction to The Paradox of Thomas Jefferson. He was the foremost advocate of liberty and equality that America has produced. He owned more than 600 human beings. He had a utopian vision of a reclusive agrarian paradise, a pastoral republic of mild-mannered, fiercely independent farmer citizens who labored in the earth by day and read Homer in the original Greek at night, yet he bought from Napoleon a territory so vast that American empire became an inevitability. His Virgilian farmers, meanwhile, were slashing and burning every acre of the West they could get their hands on and killing or expelling the indigenous peoples as fast as possible. He admired American Indians, excavated their burial mounds, studied their languages, celebrated their anarchic political arrangements, and famously commiserated their plight. But as a statesman, he lost no opportunity to dispossess them of their lands. He advocated strict interpretation of the U.S. Constitution as our peculiar security, yet he made an uneasy peace with broad construction to make the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 and to incorporate the new territory into the existing Union. He feared executive authority and accused Alexander Hamilton and others of being monocrats and Anglo-men, yet as president he enforced his pet embargo and went after the unscrupulous Aaron Burr with a ruthlessness that bordered at times on mania. In doing so, he accumulated more executive power than any president until Lincoln. Just two more paragraphs. He was a harmony obsessive who intoned the language of pacifism, yet he repeatedly threatened war against Spain, and one of the first acts of his presidency was to send an expeditionary force to bloody the nose of the pirates of the North African states. He was America's greatest champion of freedom of expression, yet as president, he encouraged, quote, a few wholesome prosecutions of the partisan Federalist press at the state level. He said, truth is great and will prevail if left to itself. Yet as the founder of the University of Virginia, he insisted upon a bowdlerized edition of David Hume's Tory History of Great Britain, lest the minds of young Virginians be prejudiced against republicanism. And late in life, he doctored his correspondence to convince posterity that he had been less naive about the French Revolution than he actually was in 1787. He was a public advocate of frugality, and he died hopelessly in debt. Thomas Jefferson was a paradox. That's the beginning.
You've drawn out the examples, but you haven't given me answers completely.
Well, you have to read the rest of the book.
Well, you only brought two pages. How can I?
Well, I will give it to you, and you would be the best reader because you know my voice, its strengths and weaknesses, and you could say, oh, wait a minute, I think you need to explain this a little better, or I'm not so sure that that's really fair to Mr. Jefferson, or I think you're being too nice to Jefferson.
I think here. We should get some feedback from your listeners, and if they're interested, perhaps you can bring some more in and we'll talk.
Well, let's post this piece.
Sure.
And with maybe we can post Bowles' introduction. I don't know if that's legal.
Probably not.
We can post a few sentences from it.
I know that you can go to Amazon if you have an e-reader, and a lot of places, probably not just Amazon, but you can download a sample or read a sample online, and that's a good way to check it.
My goal is to face Jefferson in his own times, with his own worldview, generously, but critically. I don't mean that in terms of judgmentally, but with a critical eye, to try to make sense of that which is hard to make sense of in him. You know, there's nothing paradoxical about John Adams. There's nothing paradoxical about George Washington. There's nothing paradoxical about Patrick Henry. Of all of the people of this era, there's one and only one huge paradox, and it's Thomas Jefferson. And yet, he was the third president. He held almost every other public office that was available at the time. He was beloved by people like James Madison and James Monroe and William Short and Meriwether Lewis, adored by his children and grandchildren, central figure in American life. And yet, somehow at the center of Jefferson, there are these strange, seemingly irreconcilable impulses and opinions. It's hard to really understand. Merrill Peterson, in his famous one-volume edition, Thomas Jefferson and the New Nation, says after it was all over, he said, "I've spent 20 or more years trying to make sense of Jefferson, and I must admit that I find him impenetrable." Think of that.
That's a tough act to follow, and that's what you're talking about doing. But let's revisit this. We'll continue to talk. But right now, I think we need to bring this conversation to a close for this week and say that it's now time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
And the good news is, David, it's on an entirely unrelated subject. A man I met recently offered to send me a bunch of old radio equipment to help decorate the milk room here at the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn. He's collected old radio receivers, tabletop models, even console sets that have their own value as living room furniture. The first question I asked was whether any of the old tube-type radios still work. In the center of the question, I did my best imitation of the way the signal tended to drift in and out of clarity with a kind of "This is Berlin" sound. Today's communication systems are so reliable that they have made us forget the miracle that radio once represented. Person A speaks a sentence into a clunky microphone in London, and over the English Channel in Paris, person B hears a squawky, staticky, barely perceptible simulacrum of that sentence. The human voice was attached to something called radio waves, way over at one end of the spectrum, and somehow it rode those waves like a bucking bronco to the destination. One of my intellectual interests is the birth of broadcast news in the late 1930s. Edward R. Murrow and one of my heroes, William L. Shirer, author of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, made the first news roundup broadcast during the Anschluss, the German absorption of Austria, on March 13, 1938. You can hear it any time now on the Internet, an infinitely more reliable medium, but also one that involves none of the romance of radio. To make that first historic broadcast from several European capitals, Shirer and Murrow cobbled together fledgling communications technology so primitive that it's astounding that they pulled it off. Shortwave, longwave, state-owned telephone trunk lines you had to have an armed nerve center to book, all without rehearsal or any backup plans. And when they finished the 30-minute survey of European reaction to Nazism's latest aggressions, they were 100% unsure that anyone back in the United States had heard a word they had said, because the shortwave radio signals from London to New York were subject to skip and atmospheric interruption. When I was a boy, I became a ham radio operator. My call sign was WB0CED. You start with a novice license, which permits only Morse code, and move your way by tests up to general, advanced, or amateur extra status. I built my first transmitter on a 6-inch piece of plexiglass with a few resistors, a capacitor, and wire that I wound around plastic pill bottles. I called it the HB17, homebrew, 17 watts of broadcast power. And from my basement lair in Dickinson, North Dakota, I tapped out Morse code conversations with amateur operators in 37 states, 5 Canadian provinces, and 4 or 5 European countries. Then, after a summer of hard labor, I built a Heathkit SB-102, the best voice transceiver available to the lumpen middle class at the time. On Friday nights, while my classmates met at Gravel Road Crossroads to drink beer and hope for dalliance, I sat at a gray metal table worthy of Warsaw and said things like, "Roger that, Alpha Tango Foxtrot, that's a 10-4. The technology was always infinitely more interesting than the discourse, which, I need hardly report, had little to do with Chaucer or biblical hermeneutics. Eventually, In the time-honored Pauline way, I put aside childish things and hauled all that glorious equipment to the attic. Sometimes I miss it, the annual hamfests of other pathetic nerds, paging through the Heathkit catalog with painful longing, a weekend five of us once spent at the precise border of three states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana, with a broadcast array set up in a green canvas Montgomery Ward's tent and a quarter-mile-long wire antenna fastened to a rock on the other side of a nearby butte. When my shipment of old radios arrives, I'm going to set them up here in the barn and turn them on sometimes just to smell the tubes, a glorious hot metallic odor, and try to tune in 650 WSM on a Saturday night to hear the Grand Ole Opry, as I sometimes did, well, five times, during my misspent youth. I love it that you are hearing this, and I'm happy enough that the digital technologies of dissemination are now so automatic and reliable. But the great romance of radio is over, and with it a kind of innocence and sense of wonder. A tweet by number 45 is not a fireside broadcast by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You see those photos of whole families huddled about the radio set listening to the only good news they could hear in an exceedingly troubled world, and you just want to cry. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.